Accession number 27083, reel 63.
Your excuse, Sir Henry, for briefing the press on the record was that the directive had come from Francis Pym, but you were doing it in John Knott's time.
My excuse, but I was never seriously challenged on it, was that I wanted to put the record straight in advance of the occurrence, to anything to drum up a bit of support against what amounted to the decimation of the Navy. As simple as that. But that was a backtrack, rather.
May I ask how many of these briefings did you undertake before John Knott presumably said, no, don't do any more? Or did he not say that?
He didn't say that.
He let you go, so to speak.
Oh, yes, absolutely. It was Francis Pym that initiated this thing. It was never rescinded. But of interest, only in the last two or three weeks, I speak now today, there was a piece in the Times I read that the present Defence Secretary, Geoff Hoon, had abolished the posts of DPR, Director of Public Relations, held by each of the three services individually, and that the matter, such matters, would be handled by the central staff. This is
within his department, of course.
Within his department.
Yeah.
This was another approach to achieving precisely the same thing, namely the stifling of communication with the press. Not a clever thing to do, because it will inevitably result, and I'm coming on to leaks in a moment, it will inevitably result in more leaks, not less, and leaks are, on the whole, leaks are pretty reprehensible. They constitute a breach of trust. And whether it be on a personal basis or on a whole service basis, it really has to be the latter to be other than pretty reprehensible. I'm not a pro-leaker at all. And that's what it'll result in. No. Mark my words. Well, at about this time, going back now to whatever, 81, I suppose, there were periodic leaks. Nothing to do with me, nothing to do with my relations with the press and so forth. I don't think I really achieved very much, other than to establish some relations. And I remember having... who was, I think it was the Telegraph, and Desmond Wetton was around at the time, and Desmond Wetton was very pro-Navy, but he had this astonishing affliction, really, of always getting it wrong. And on a number of occasions, I would actually dictate passages to him, and he would turn them inside out. And he, instead of commando ships, he would publish assault ships and vice versa, and that sort of thing. It didn't do any harm, but it didn't. It sort of made them. It made the clock strike 13. And therefore the whole article became suspect. He was very loyal to the Navy, but it was a very curious result. And I remember, I can't remember which paper it was, and it's probably just as well, and it doesn't matter. But with some difficulty, it might have been something like the Sunday Times, but I don't know. And the editor, or an editor, I had to sort of persuade these people to invite me out to lunch. That was the way to do it. So I did. And he had me out to lunch, and he had two guys with him, one of whom is a great tall streak, nice young man, in his, I should think, early 20s, who was a defense correspondent. And I can't remember which paper this was. I wish I could.
Would it be the Sunday Telegraph?
It might have been. It might have been. I'm not sure. Anyway.
And the young man was extremely tall.
Extremely tall, yes.
Yes.
Do you know his name?
Yes, I think so. Simon O'Dwyer Russell.
It doesn't ring a bell. I could check up from my...
He was defense correspondent of the Telegraph, I think, starting at about that.
Well, it doesn't really matter which it was, because there's nothing anti that particular newspaper about it. But it just indicates the sort of things that went on. And there was I trying desperately to get a portion of the truth, not the whole truth, but some of the facts out, because the public was being grossly misled. Anyway, I contrived my invitation to lunch. I was taken out to lunch, and we sat down at a table in some restaurant, and this editor, who was clearly bored rigid by the whole thing, and who I took an instant dislike to, everything about him seemed to me to be wrong, and we sat down, and he stopped short of saying, do you want something to eat, having asked me to lunch, having, I admit, been more or less told to ask me to lunch. And so we selected something to eat. And then he did literally say, do you want to have something to drink? And I said, yes, I'd like a glass of wine. He said, I'm not sure whether he had a glass of wine or not. It doesn't matter. But he was really a nasty bit of work, and I disliked him intensely from the word go. But quite quickly, especially as I'm a very slow eater, and I was on the business of defense, so I wanted to do my business with this tall, lanky chap, who was a very nice lad, I think. And again, I dictated various passages simply to get the facts straight. A class of ship, or the name of a ship, or whatever the circumstances were, and so forth. And it came out, it was, I think, definitely a Sunday paper, but which one, I can't be sure, it was probably the Telegraph or the Times. And it came out a week or even two later, and it was obviously a gap filler. Well, all right, I couldn't have expected more, frankly, because it wasn't a crisis of that particular week. It was part of the general crisis of the overall defense review. And this chap got it absolutely inside out and upside down, which was interesting. And it gave one pause for thought as to whether it was worthwhile to continue with this, because if they always got it wrong, it frankly didn't do much good. It misled the public. You had no comeback. You were breaching the rules yourself in doing it at all. So it was quite a sticky wicket to bat on. Well, at about this time occurred a sort of a succession of pretty minor leaks. And I can't remember, I can't even give you an example. They were quite minor leaks. But they were leaks. They were reprehensible. They were unnecessary. They did nobody any good. I'm as convinced as I can be that they did not come from the naval staff, and I doubt that they came from any service staff, but that's another matter. Whether they came from a disgruntled civil servant or what the origin was, I don't know. But after about leak number three, which went on over a period of, weeks, if not months, the authority turned and said, this must be investigated. And so there was a witch hunt. It got nowhere. But the witch hunt was set up towards the end of one of the working weeks. And the OK phrase at the time was, in terms of reference of the investigation, was to find the mole. And I came back for the weekend, and I'd had trouble living next door then with the big lawn. I'd had trouble with moles in my lawn. And I thought what fun it would be if only I could catch a mole, which is quite a difficult thing to do. So I did have some mole traps. And then I could present it to Frank Cooper, who was by way of being a friend, but I thought needed a bit of jogging along from time to time vis-à-vis the Navy. And I set my traps on a Friday night, and on the Saturday, no go at all. And I set them again on the Saturday night, and sure enough, on the Sunday morning, I had a mole. And I put it in a little coffin-like box, which was designed to contain after eights, and it fitted exactly. And I wrote a little note on top, and put it in an envelope and sent it along to the permanent secretary, saying that I understood that he was searching for a mole. Here was a mole. Was it the right one? He took it very well, and he wrote me a charming note back. He needn't have said anything at all, but I felt very much better after that.
Can I just ask this question, as Frank Cooper's name has come up? What was his... He is the most senior civil servant, the permanent secretary in the Ministry of Defence.
Yes.
What was his position? Did you ever glean, in as much as civil servants ever reveal anything about their private thoughts, did you, A, ever glean anything about his private thoughts about the PIMNOT review? And B, do you think to any extent that he might have initiated any element of it, or did he just simply was handed off the shelf in May, June 79 with the Conservative election a package and said, here we go?
I don't think he was involved in the sorting out of the allocation of the cuts. He sat on top of those, like DOSP policy, who kept an eye on whether people were saying ridiculous things. And, for example, I've already mentioned that the cost of Trident fell entirely to the Navy. I actually made a point of seeing Frank Cooper and putting this to him and saying, this is absurd. I also put it direct, verbally, to John Knott. And said it was, and he simulated surprise in saying, well, said things like, but surely the honour of the Navy having the National Independent Strategic Nuclear Deterrent and all that stuff. And I said, well, having the deterrent doesn't actually attract people to the Navy. It doesn't help maintain the size and shape and capability of the fleet. It is a national thing, it is supra. Single service. And I personally, against some strong advice from the naval staff, who said, if you didn't support this, we might get the thing spread or something. I don't think we would have done, actually. And I said, I'm not prepared to do that. I'm not prepared to raise it in the chiefs. If it actually came to the point, I would volunteer to have this facility, even at the cost, which in the event it was, of other things in the Navy, because I think you've got to think bigger than that. And there were those in the naval staff who didn't agree and didn't like it, but that was it. But I went along to Frank Cooper and said, no, this really is absurd that the Navy should be made to pay for this, and it's all we find the Defence Secretary waffling about the honour of the responsibility for and so forth, but the honor doesn't cut metal and produce hardware, and so on. And he actually went so far as to say, "Ah, yes, we must do something about this," but it was never done. And we became very good friends, actually. And he was a straight guy, but he didn't get that one right. Now, I'm not quite sure where in time I was, and I've rather been dotting about.
Well, at one point you were, you chased John Knott down to Cornwall in November 81. But then I think that you digressed slightly on the purchase of Trident D5, which I assume...
Yes, and I think I ever ran on time. I go back now to... I see that things had got to such a pass by May 81 that I minuted the Prime Minister direct, copied it, of course, to the Secretary of State, in which I pointed out, it was quite a long minute, and I pointed out the ridiculous nature of this astonishing imbalance of cuts as applied to the three armed services.
6 months before, you chased John Knott down Cornwall.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
And I sent this across and exercised my right to demand a personal interview with her, with the Prime Minister. And this was initially set up for the 8th of June, but I'm sorry, it was before that, it was sometime in May, I think, shortly after, say a week or two later, and something intervened and she couldn't see me then. But I stuck to my guns and made it quite clear that I still wished to see her and was not supposed to let the matter drop. And I actually saw her on the 8th of June, and I kept John Knott fully informed of these events. And on my way across to Downing Street, I called at Knott's office to take him with me. And he was very decent about it. He said, no, I think it would be very much better if you went on your own. And I said, Secretary of State, I'd rather not. I think you really must come with me. I'll tell you now, I had things to say which you are not going to like, and which I would rather you heard to your face than picking up a scuttlebutt behind your back later on. And he came, which was the decent thing to do. And we went into number 10, and the Prime Minister, with her private secretary, who had been on the naval, a civil servant on the naval staff, and I knew him very well. This was...
All right.
Well, the Prime Minister was, she was standing there, and then she sat down with my paper that I'd written to her in her hand. And she wasn't in a particularly cooperative mood, because I think she read it that I was rocking the Defence Review boat, which, so far as she could judge at the time, was proceeding on certainly much improved lines, and that she was going to get her slice of the cake, which is really what she was concerned about. And she gave me a very cold look and leant forward and said, well, what would you do? And I said, I would hand over 2 to 3 billion to the army. To the army, she said. You mean the Navy? No, I said, I mean the army. Why on earth would you do that? In order, I said, to reproduce back in the UK the necessary barracks and supporting stuff for what is currently called the British Army of the Rhine. And I would operate the British Army of the Rhine with a small operational headquarters and the main units of whatever size you, within NATO dictate, would go on a rule-mon basis. And at the moment, they have no barracks back in UK to which to return. And, for example, it is quite a normal thing for a fairly junior army officer out there with his family and all the panoply of married quarters and supporting stuff to be there for 12 years. And this at a cost of whatever the figure was then, it was something like 360 million a year in Deutschmarks, foreign exchange. And I got that much out. And John Knott intervened and said, oh, we've been into that, Prime Minister, and it's too expensive. We had not actually been into that fully, not in any real depth. And he had little intention of doing so. And I lost that round. And it was of interest that when I ran this sort of theme, when I tried this out with, for example, Wim Brummel, he thought it'd be the end of the army. But if you tried it on anybody up to the level of half colonel or even full colonel, and full colonel wasn't a terribly go-ahead job at that time, you probably went straight from half colonel to brigadier. They saw the wisdom of it, and they thought that it was virtually inevitable sooner or later for that to occur. And of course it did, but it wasn't done then. At about that time...
That was the end of the meeting that you happened to
be at? That was the end of the meeting, yeah. It was a notice written about, and I got no over the Prime Minister. And it didn't influence John Knott one iota, because he'd made his mind up. But at about that time, it was on a Sunday down here next door in my old house, and the telephone rang, and it was Edward Ashmore, my predecessor, but two. And he asked if he could come and see me. So, of course, I said yes, and he arrived about 11:30, and I gave him a glass of sherry, took him into my study, gave him a glass of sherry, and he said, I've discussed it with Peter Hill Morton, and we think that you should resign and put it on the line. Well, this came, as you might suppose, as something of a bolt from the blue. And I said there and then, that's interesting. I will, of course, think about what you have to say, but my immediate reaction is to oppose that proposition and to say no, because in my book, you resign if you're caught with your fingers in the till or in the vestry with a choir boy. You do not resign as a serving officer. You do not resign on a point of principle. You resign on a point of honor, dishonor. And if you think back, I went on, for the only resignation in recent times, namely of David Luce over the Carrier battle, and he resigned, and it was a two-inch column in some of the dailies for one day only. It had no effect whatsoever then. If I went on my own now, it probably wouldn't even get 2 inches in next day's paper. Even if now I went and I took the entire Admiralty Board with me, I don't believe that that would alter the circumstances which would have driven us to do so. But I'll think about it some more, and I'll let you know my decision. And we parted on those terms.
And his reasoning for you to resign?
He didn't give it. Well, just to put it on the line, then you could tell the whole truth, as opposed to any bits of it, which are what I had been dribs and drabs doing with the media.
Through, yeah. Okay.
And that evening I rang up Peter Hill Norton, who put rather a different slant on it, and said, oh, my dear Henry, it's entirely your decision. You know, you and any you must do what you think best. And I told him my reasoning, and he said, yes, well, I don't disagree with any of that. And I rang Ashmore back and told him that I wasn't going to take his advice. And that was that one. But it's not generally known, that, I don't think. And it was an interesting proposition. I think a pretty fatuous one, but that's another matter. But it came from a clever man, and so you paid attention to him.
And I was just going to say that, as far as I can recall, neither gentleman included it in their interviews with me. Either Edward Ashmore last year or Peter Hill Norton earlier this year.
Well, I'm not surprised that Peter Hill Norton didn't. I'm not really surprised that Edward Ashmore didn't, because I think subsequently he felt probably rather ashamed of it. But I don't know. It's for him to say. Not long afterwards, we had, again it was in Portsmouth, it was the half year. So we're now talking of June, I suppose, 81. We had the half-yearly promotion meeting of the Admiralty Board and Commanders-in-Chief as was the custom. The midsummer meeting was in Portsmouth. And we got through the agenda. I was in the chair. We got through the agenda, and I recounted to those assembled what I just told you about this resignation business, what my reaction had been, and said, looking around the table, I would be glad of your views on this in case you think I've got it wrong. I will now hand over the chair to the Second Sea Lord, who was Desmond Cassidy, and I will await your deliberations in another room. And I left the room. And there was nowhere else to go, actually, so I was sort of strolling about the passages. And it was a little rather in for a dig. And I was out there for something like 20 minutes. It was quite a long time. I thought it would take about three. And they'd almost certainly give me support. They took 20. And what the hell they were talking about all that time, I still don't know. Because I went back in and they said, no, we give a full support. It was an interesting situation. I really had put my head on the line. In the late summer, I spent, yes, almost the autumn, I think, of 81, the Argentine sail training ship, the Libertad, came and moored off Greenwich. And I received an invitation to visit them, which I accepted, and it was to be in the latter part of the forenoon, and then I was to stay on for lunch. And I got in touch with the captain of the ship. They didn't have an admiral on board, and asked if that's what they really wanted, or whether they'd prefer me to have, say, a couple of dozen of their officers back to the Mall Flat, and I would give them lunch. No, they would like me to stay to lunch. So down I went by car, and was taken off in the launch. And as we approached the ship, I saw that they had really gone to town, and they'd manned all the masts and yards. And drawn up on one side of the quarterdeck were all the officers. And drawn up on the other side was a Royal Guard of 96 or whatever. So I walked down the Royal Guard first. And although most of the officers spoke quite a bit of English, the sailors did not. When I finished inspecting the guard, I turned to the captain and said, asked him if he would, said how greatly honored I was that he had manned ship. But would he now unman ship and lay everybody off so that I could thank them for the honor they had done me? and then I walked down the officer's line. Well, they didn't lay off, they sort of went in divisions around the ship, and so did I, and through an interpreter, thanked them for what they'd done, and walked slowly along the front rank of each division, and so on. And, you know, this was all good, cheerful stuff, and you got smiles, but you couldn't communicate, really. They appeared to be grateful for my few words through the interpreter, but I can put it any more strongly than that. And then down I went to the wardroom, and they all gathered around, and it was a very happy lot, and we had a drink or two. And then, together with Naval Attaché and the captain and the executive officer, and there were a couple of others, and I had with me only my naval assistant. And we went aft to the cuddy for a very happy and a very good lunch. And it really was a very happy occasion, and we were chatting and laughing away. We weren't talking in his shop. And it couldn't have been a nicer...
Excuse me.